Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 9, Dodd-Frank Developments and Derivatives. Thomas D'Ambrosio, Mike Phillip, Dan Budofsky, and Akshay Balani will discuss an overview of recent Dodd-Frank developments and issues regarding derivatives, including documentation and clearing. Now, on to the podcast.
Hi, I'm Tom D'Ambrosio. I'm a partner in the New York office. I'm here with Mike Phillip. He's a partner in the Chicago office. Dan Budofsky, partner in the New York office. And Akshay Balani, partner in the New York office, and we'll talk to you about various aspects of derivative reform and AT issues. First, I'll speak a little bit about the margin rules. The margin rules apply to swaps, and they are imposed by the prudential regulators. Those are the banking regulators as well as the CFTC. The SEC will come out with separate rules regarding margin relating to security-based swaps. The margin rules were finalized by the prudential regulators in the fall of 2015, and they became effective on April 1st of this year. But the important dates for purposes of margin for the hedge fund community are going to be in the future, and the important dates are September of this year, March of 2017, and then ultimately September of 2020. The margin rules will be phased in during that time. But September 1st is a very important date because that's the date that the large dealers that all the hedge funds use will be required to adhere to the margin regulations. And the margin regulations for the dealers will alter the way they have traditionally entered into transactions with each other. And even though the rules at the time won't impact the transactions that the dealers do with most hedge funds, the fact that the dealer will be hedging probably with another dealer counterparty and forced to comply with the margin rules will impact the pricing of your margin trades from that date. March 1st of 2017 is also crucial because that's when the rules with respect to variation margin kick in for all parties. So, what do these margin rules do? To some extent, the margin rules don't change what was done in the past, to some extent that they do. The margin rules, though, are the culmination of the Dodd-Frank reform. This was the most important aspect of what happened with respect to Dodd-Frank's attempt to rein in and modify the OTC derivative marketplace. So, the margin rules require this, essentially. Swap entities, covered swap entities, these are the big dealers, they have to collect initial margin from other swap entities, from very large financial end users, which would include the largest hedge funds, but not all hedge funds. And they have to post initial margin to these entities as well. The rule with respect to hedge funds that don't have very large exposures, and those exposures are set at $8 billion of notional over an average daily period measured during the summer months. But for those hedge funds that are below that threshold, dealers can continue to take independent amounts, upfront margin, initial margin, however you want to refer to it, at a level that they deem appropriate to address the risk inherent in the uncleared swap. And again, this is just for uncleared swaps, right? Cleared swaps, margining will be based on the clearinghouse and the FCM thresholds. Fortunately for end users, not hedge fund end users, but for end users, these requirements for initial margin don't apply to the extent that the swap is exempt from the clearing requirement by virtue of the commercial end user exception and other similar exceptions to clearing. Financial end users, just to summarize, they include hedge funds, they include commodity pools, FCMs, CPOs, CTAs, banks, brokers, insurance companies, employee benefit plans. The amount of initial margin that needs to be taken, both collected and posted, and the timing are important. It's T plus one basis, so your IM has to be collected and posted at T plus one. And the amount, although there can be a cushion of $50 million, for a threshold, the amount has got to be the amount that is set by rule or alternatively, an amount set by margin as long as the regulator has approved the internal margin model that the dealer wants to use for that. The standard set in the rule is not terrible, but it's also not that great. It ranges from 1% to 15%. And again, this is initial margins, not variation mark-to-market margin. With respect to variation margin, again, March 1st, 2017 is the date, no exceptions. A variation margin will apply across the board, as it is pretty much the case now. But dealers will have to both collect and post variation margin. MTAs can't be in excess of $500,000, and that's the minimum transfer amount when I say MTAs. Variation margin must be in cash. Okay, cash. No agencies, no treasuries any longer. Variation margin is in cash. Fortunately, it's not just limited to U.S. dollars. It's U.S. dollars, major currencies, or the currency of settlement for the transaction. Initial margin, fortunately, includes cash and some other approved collateral. It's the standard basket of collateral that's considered safe, so treasuries, agencies, various governments. It includes equities, if they're in the major indices, all subject to discounting, by the way, but it does include equities and includes gold. There are types of collateral that are not included. Those would be securities of affiliates, securities of banking entities or their affiliates, securities of market intermediaries, and non-bank financial institutions supervised by the Fed. So those types of securities are taken out of the package entirely. The discounts, this gives the discounts that would apply to the types of eligible collateral that one could post. And it ranges from a 0.5% discount to 25% discount. That's on the lesser cap equities. The other important element of the margin rules is that initial margin, not variation margin, but initial margin has to be held, both initial margin that's collected and initial margin that's posted, needs to be held at a custodian. Now, this is a windfall for the custodial banks, but all of the initial margin now has to be taken away from the dealer and the end user and held by a custodian. And the custodian cannot be affiliated to either party or any of their affiliates. Of course, there has to be a written agreement, as one might expect, and that agreement's got to be enforceable, but they usually are, so that's not a problem. And this is a big change, because this applied to mutual funds, registered investment companies in the past, but to no other parties, and now it applies to all parties. Cross-border rules, the margin rules don't apply if everything's offshore, and there is the possibility of substituted compliance and to the extent that a transaction will cover both jurisdictions, both the domestic and foreign jurisdictions. So look for more changes to come. The CSAs will change. All of your collateral agreements will change or need to be modified. And that is unfortunately the scheme of the margin regulations. The real problem there is, of course, extra administrative burdens and extra costs. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike.
Thanks, Tom. What I want to talk about is the CFTC's proposed rule, Regulation Automated Trading, otherwise known as Reg AT. The rule was proposed at the end of last year after a three-year deliberative and consultative process. The comment period ended in March. This is a 125-page rule in the Federal Register, by the way. There were over 60 comment letters posted. The CFTC's been reviewing it. The chairman of the CFTC says this is a rule in some form that is going to get approved before the end of the year. There will be a roundtable that the CFTC is holding, a staff roundtable tomorrow to talk about certain aspects of the rule. So something in some form is coming soon. What the rule is designed to do is to address various issues relating to algorithmic trading and futures or swaps that are traded on a futures exchange. While the CFTC recognized that automated trading provides a lot of advantages in terms of speed, volume, and efficiency, those same aspects of automated trading could have a disruptive effect if the algos don't operate properly. And so the basic regulatory concern relates to the potential for market disruptions if algo trading systems break down. The proposed rule covers a lot of territory. It includes registration requirements for proprietary trading firms who use algo trading that work not previously required to register with the commission, and it creates a new category of regulated person called a AT person. An AT persons would be required to adopt policies and procedures covering pre- and post-trade risk controls, the development, testing, and monitoring of algo trading systems, and training of personnel, record keeping, and reporting requirements. It would impose layered and, in some cases, overlapping or redundant requirements on AT persons, the trading firms as well as their intermediaries, the FCMs, and exchanges. So the first important concept is to understand, for purposes of Reg AT, what is algorithmic trading? What's within the scope? And the definition is extremely broad. It's not just high-frequency trading, but basically the definition includes any order, modification to order, or cancellation that is electronically submitted for processing on a futures exchange where one or more computer algos or systems determines whether to initiate, modify, or cancel the order, or otherwise makes determinations with respect to an order. So, you know, what's covered by that, you know, arbitrage strategies, hedging or loss limit algos that generate orders on an automated basis, simultaneous spread strategies, order generation programs that slice orders into large orders into smaller pieces, uses of parents and child orders, VWAPs or TWAP orders, and that includes as well third-party algos that are provided by your FCMs. It doesn't have to be an algo that you have created or originated. It can be if someone provides one to you and you use it, it's covered and you could be potentially covered by this rule. What is excluded? Essentially, the only real carve-out from the definition is for orders whose every parameter is manually entered into on a front-end system with no further discretion by any computer system or algo prior to its electronic submission for processing by the exchange. So, an idea generator, if you have an algo that only generates ideas or investment allocations, but does not automatically generate orders to the exchange, and so the orders have to be entered manually by a human being, that would not be an algo covered by this rule. Or an order router that simply follows instructions to route an order to a specified exchange and has no discretion as to which exchange to send it to, that also would not be covered. But basically, any other algo that can generate orders and send it to an exchange will be covered. The second important concept is who is captured as an AT person. There are really two categories. Any entity that's required to register with the CFTC in any capacity, and so importantly for this audience, CPOs and CTAs. So if you're required to register as a CPO, CTA, and you engage in algo trading as just described, you would be defined as an AT person and you will have a lot of obligations that we're going to talk about. The second category is for proprietary trading firms that previously were not required to register with the CFTC if they engage in algo trading, but they do so through direct electronic access to an exchange, a futures exchange, then they will now have to register as floor traders and will also be AT persons. And AT persons are going to be required to meet extensive regulatory requirements related to risk management, development, testing, and monitoring requirements, as well as compliance and training. I want to walk through some of those quickly. The first obligation is that they will have to maintain pre-trade risk controls, and they'll have to implement pre-trade risk controls such as message and order execution throttles, order price parameter boundaries, maximum order size limits, and kill switches. Where the AT person sets those parameters will be left up to them, but they will have to have all these controls. They'll also have to have standards for development and testing of their algo trading systems, and those standards must include maintaining an algo development environment that is adequately isolated from the production trading environment, testing algo codes and related systems to make sure that they comply with exchange, CFTC, and internal policies and procedures, performing back testing and stress tests of the algo code, and maintaining a source code repository, which we'll touch on in a moment. There will also be an element that AT persons must have policies and procedures that subject each AT system continuous real-time monitoring by knowledgeable and qualified staff while the AT system is engaged in trading. And importantly, this monitoring staff must be persons who are not engaged in the trading while performing the monitoring. So that means you can't use the traders who are using the algos to perform the monitoring. You'll have to have separate staff for that. There'll be a training requirement as well that AT persons must designate which staff are subject to training and then have a training program for all those designated personnel. There is also an annual compliance report requirement that AT persons will be required to submit to each futures exchange on which they engage in algo trading an annual report describing in detail their pre-trade risk controls and a description of all the parameters and their specific quantitative settings that they use. The annual report must be certified by the CEO or the CCO of the AT person. I alluded to a source code repository. This is one of the more controversial aspects of the rule, that AT persons would be required to maintain a repository containing all the source code to manage persistence and copies of all the code used in the automated trading, and that this source code would have to be made available upon demand to the CFTC or the DOJ without the need for a subpoena. Many market participants have raised a lot of concerns about confidentiality, cybersecurity, and intellectual property about this, and we'll see whether it remains in the current form in the final rule. So what should you be doing to prepare? Don't know what the final rule is going to look like, but you should ask yourself the following questions. Do you use algorithmic trading systems? Are you registered as a CPO or CTA? If the answer to both of those is yes, then you're going to be an AT person and you will have obligations. Take an inventory of your algos. Take an inventory of your pre-trade risk controls. Review your existing development and testing protocols. Do you have any written policies and procedures in place now? Perform a gap analysis to determine what additional controls or personnel would be needed to comply with the rules as proposed.
Thanks. I'm Dan Badovsky. I'm going to give you in 3 minutes, like a very, very quick heads up in case you thought you were done ever having to worry about protocols from ISDA. Another one that was published on May 5th, 2016. It's called the ISDA Resolution Stay Jurisdictional Modular Protocol. If you've heard about the stay protocol, you will now perhaps start getting questions about it, being asked to sign up to it. This was designed to facilitate compliance with special resolution regimes, which I'll very quickly describe. And what's different about what you've seen in state protocols for the last couple of years is that now it's really aimed at the buy side. What does it have to do with? It has to do with protected termination rights and derivatives. But by derivatives, now we're talking swaps, sec lending, and repo. Most of you know that before the crisis and even now, these termination rights, which are you could terminate if your counterparty defaults, including with some kind of insolvency event, they go into a bankruptcy, or perhaps it's a cross default, which now is meaning an affiliate or a credit support provider or a parent or a guarantor. If there's an insolvency at that level, you have the right to terminate your contract. And under insolvency laws, you've known that you can liquidate and close that out, notwithstanding any automatic stay. Well, after the crisis, members of the Financial Stability Board got together and said, globally, we should pass legislation which does things to prevent a Lehman-type situation where you have this systemically important financial institution that has an insolvency, everybody closes everything out, and the thing goes down, taxpayers have to bail it out. One of the important aspects of this notion of putting in place special resolution regimes was to put some kind of stay on the ability of counterparties to close out derivatives contracts on the day of the insolvency. And it was understood that it would be essentially a temporary stay, generally not more than 2 business days, and subject to a bunch of other conditions. That was in 2011 in a document called the Key Attributes. That's been implemented. Now there are 11 jurisdictions that have those kinds of statutes in place, including the ones that are listed on the slide. And the provisions vary generally somewhat, but they're generally the same. Why do you need a protocol if you have these statutes in these different jurisdictions? Well, the concern in large part is because there's been a concern that maybe their cross-border impact is not clear. Maybe if, for example, you have a U.S. counterparty that enters into a transaction with another U.S. counterparty that's a subsidiary of a U.K. parent, and that UK parent is subject to some kind of insolvency, a special resolution regime that imposes a stay, will a court in the U.S. applying New York law, assuming it's a New York-governed contract, will it respect that offshore special resolution regime? So this is essentially a contractual approach, which requires everyone who adheres to this to amend their documentation to say, we're going to, whether or not it's applicable as a matter of law, we're going to, as a contractual matter, treat our contracts as though they're subject to these types of stays. There was a version of it in 2014, which was really interdealer in what they call the G18, the major international global dealers. It was amended in 2015, mostly to include SEC lending and repo, as I mentioned. Now in 2016, now there's this JMP. I want to call it the JUMP. I don't know if anybody else is doing that. But the JMP, which effectively now brings in the buy side. So the interesting thing about it is that it has this kind of protocol aspect to it. You can select which jurisdiction you want to sign up for and which types of regulated counterparties you're willing to adhere to. So it gives you some of these choices, and these are the mechanics, which you can take a look at your leisure. The UK module is now open, and that's what you may start seeing requests to sign up, depending on what kind of counterparty you are. You may need to do it either by June 1st or by January 1st. Sorry, it was abbreviated and only a few couple minutes, but good luck.
I'm not going to talk about something that's particularly new. If you've been trading in these markets in the OTC, clear derivatives markets, kind of a misnomer there, but clearing's been live since 2012. You know, I mean, CFTC came out with a clearing determination back then for interest rate swaps. Since then, there's index credit default swaps, which are subject to mandatory clearing. This kind of piggybacks off of what Tom was saying. So just to take a step back, and I'm not really going to go through the slides. You're happy to talk to them if you guys want to talk after the break. So you've got margin for uncleared swaps coming into effect. It's going to be expensive to trade them, and that's going to come into effect as early as this year, right? And it's going to change the economics of trading in these markets. We've been working with clearing now since 2012. It's actually gone quite smoothly. Here's just a list here of some of the products that have historically been required to be cleared. And of course, my slide is out of date because today the CFTC this afternoon came out with another clearing determination. So it's an evolving process. I call it glowing global here because if you're trading in offshore markets, we have clearing that is now becoming live in the EU with the regulatory technical standards having been passed and clearing determinations being made. So if you're trading in interest rate swaps, you're trading in index credit default swaps, you understand clearing, you're set up to do it operationally. The next clearing mandate, we think, and it's been talked about for a while, are non-deliverable forwards. So that's something that's going to be coming on the horizon. If you guys don't normally trade in the other products that I mentioned, you may have exposure to NDFs. So start thinking about, you know, what it's going to require to clear and face a central counterparty as opposed to your bilateral swap counterparty. One of the things that I would mention is that once something is required to be cleared, it becomes generally made available to trade by a swap execution facility. So now you're not calling up your broker and saying, I want to enter into a swap on these terms. You're actually trading on a platform. And that's kind of the general convergence of futures and swaps. Their swaps effectively are becoming futurized and traded on platforms and starting to become more standardized. You can always do a bespoke swap. You may just have to deal with the margin rules. And so this is just a fun slide that I will go through very quickly. This is what clearing looks like under Dodd-Frank. It's really complicated. Some would think unnecessarily so. Certainly, I'll be here at the break if anybody wants to talk further. That's it. Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan, Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan, Lewis & its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.